This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, I'm Ken Tangen. This is episode 34 of What's It Like. My guest is Chuck DeVore, a major politician.
I wouldn't say major. I'd say, you know, President Obama and Speaker Boehner are major. Perhaps a local political figure would be a more accurate and more appropriate way to put it.
But you're in California. You grew up in Seattle, though, didn't you?
Well, I spent the first, 11, 12 years of my life up in the Puget Sound area, moved to Vancouver, Washington for a couple of years, then moved to the Eastern High Sierra in 1976. And I've lived in California ever since, other than brief stints out of state for political or military purposes.
Well, see, I was born in Seattle, so good people come from Seattle. So what was your childhood like?
Well, I think it had kind of a typical Seattle upbringing, a lot of time out on the water, fishing, salmon fishing. Spent a fair amount of time with my grandparents. Unfortunately, my parents got divorced when I was three, and so there was a fair amount of time that I spent with my grandparents, both my mother's mother and my dad's parents, up in Ferndale, Washington, about 12 miles from the Canadian border. Just was in Boy Scouts, studied hard in school, fairly unremarkable childhood, I think. I ended up moving to the Eastern High Sierra to live with my dad when I was 13 and help him with his auto parts store that he ran in Mammoth Lakes. It was a time of gas lines and high inflation it's a pretty challenging time to be running a auto parts store in a resort community. I had a 59 Willys Jeep was my first car, had four stick shifts and 32 different gear combinations, and I drove that Jeep all over the Eastern High Sierra from Mono Lake down to Death Valley and all points in between, and I think that was my dad's secret conspiratorial plan, because that Jeep got 10 miles to the gallon, and at the time, in inflation-adjusted dollars, gasoline then was more expensive than it is today, which meant that when I wasn't studying or playing basketball or football, I was working for my dad in the auto parts store, working for my uncle in the mobile station, or cleaning condominiums, because that's the only way I could buy enough fuel and ammunition to suit my taste at the time. So I was pretty busy keeping that Jeep filled with gas.
So how did your parents impact your worldview?
Well, they're both hardworking. They're both individuals who politically are conservative, and obviously for me, politics is a big part of my life. My mother especially was active and remains active in politics. In fact, in recent years, she's been chairman of the Pinal County Republican Party just east of Phoenix in Arizona. And so she is someone that I certainly take my love of politics and elections and things like that from. I think that both of my parents were from a generation that emphasized self-reliance and hard work. That's certainly something that, my father especially passed on to me. If you want something, work for it. And, I did and remain kind of hue to that that way of thinking. And so I think with most people, their parents are a huge part of their, how they ended up shaped as an adult.
Mm-hmm. What was your major challenge in school?
In high school, I think it was, as I think back on it, it was probably playing football. I was very tall and very skinny. From the very first day in my high school, I was the tallest guy in the high school. I mean, of course, it wasn't a very big high school. My graduating class was 43. But, from freshman to my senior year, I was the tallest guy in my high school. And on the football team, I remember my first year, I was 6'2 and 129 pounds. I was the second lightest guy on the team. I put on a lot of mass in the next 2 years of playing football. In fact, my quarterback in my sophomore year was Trace Gallagher, who's a fairly well-known Fox News anchor. We called him Hollywood back then, kind of prescient given what he ended up doing today. But, for me, academics was never all that much of a problem. I was my freshman class president. I was the sophomore class vice president. But football was something that I dwelled on because I knew that there'd be, you know, a couple of hours of pain and discomfort. It was either, you know, too hot or too cold or too windy out on that practice field at 8,000 feet in altitude. In retrospect, you know, as I look at the life's lessons learned on the football field for me, learning to overcome fear and pain, getting back into a play, because when you get knocked down, you never know if you can contribute, if you get back up again as quickly as possible. Even though I carry with me scars from my football years in high school, I believe that I would not have succeeded as a military officer or as a person seeking public office were it not for the life's lessons learned on the football field in high school. I'd say that football was probably my biggest challenge in high school. And in college, you know, again, college wasn't particularly difficult for me. You know, I had one difficult class with a calculus class that was taught by a professor who was from mainland China and wasn't a particularly good English language speaker, and that caused me to have, you know, some problems learning calculus in college. So I ended up taking a business calculus class, and I think that ended up triggering my switch from being a geology major, where, you know, with a Bachelor of Science degree you had to have calculus, to wimping out and going into the liberal arts, and ultimately getting a degree from Claremont Mechanic College in strategic studies. And I was able to get that degree at Claremont because I competed for and won an Army scholarship that paid for 2 years of college at Claremont. I was working my way through Cal State Fullerton as a union carpenter up to the point that I earned the scholarship. So I guess the toughest thing in college was that dang calculus class that I ended up dropping out from, and before taking an incomplete. You know, occasionally I still have cold sweat nightmares about that dang class and you know, wondering if I forgot my homework or something. I think other than that one singular instance, I enjoyed college. I ended up graduating with honors from Claremont, which is something that Claremont, compared to other schools anyway, has a pretty strict restriction on. They only allow no more than one-third of a graduating class to have honors, so it's kind of tough to have grade inflation at that school.
Yeah. Now that you survived childhood, what constitutes family for you?
Oh, well, I've been married for 23 years. I have two wonderful daughters, 19 and 14 years old, and I think a fairly normal or conventional family existence with the twist that I've certainly imposed quite a bit on them with my political career. You know, I think the girls are very conversant in politics, in some cases reluctantly so. You know, my wife and my girls have all contributed countless uncompensated volunteer hours, whether willingly or unwillingly, on the campaign trail. So we've got our immediate family, and we're taking care of my in-laws right now. They are both suffering from two different forms of mental degradation or dementia. And my father-in-law is 86 years old and a World War II vet, where he went into the Normandy area about 10 days after the invasion. My mother-in-law is 83. And then we have two shelter cats that we rescued about a year ago. We've got a chinchilla. And our dog, unfortunately, we had to put down just a few days shy of his 13th birthday. He was starting to hurt. So our faithful friend. So we're down one right now, but we're thinking about perhaps getting another dog.
What's it like to become a father?
Oh, well, becoming a father was a wonderful day. Remember it all very, very clearly. As I recall, both times with both births, I ended up crying a bit. It's quite the experience, and it's quite the responsibility, and the joy is certainly returned manyfold over the tears. And I've very much enjoyed being a being a father.
So why would anyone in their right mind run for public office?
Well, there's many different reasons why people run for office. And you did say in your right mind, there is actually a number of people who run for office who are actually not in their right mind. Some of them running for ego, some of them because they're truly sociopathic or have other clinical problems. Seriously, there's actually quite a few people that run for office that I would say are a bit insane. Fortunately, the public usually sees through that, and most of the times those folks don't get elected. But generally speaking, when you see people running for office, there's, I think, a few broad categories of why people run. Some of them is some people run out of a desire for affirmation or to be confirmed by the public. Of course, that's pretty dangerous because usually only one person can win a given race, and more often than not, you're going to lose. Some people run for the power, for the prestige. They have a need to be in charge or to do things, and sometimes that, of course, is connected with a certain degree of corruption or fiduciary interest in cutting corners and personally benefiting. And I think that a good number of people run for office because they have a certain set of ideals or a certain philosophy that they would like to see practically implemented. And, of course, that would include people who are on the left that I don't often agree with, as well as people who are conservative with whom I would find common agreement. For me, I look at the challenges facing this nation, facing the state of California, facing our local area, and I believe that it's a very serious set of challenges. Certainly, I wouldn't say that it rises to the level of what we've had in the past on the verge of the Civil War or the American Revolution, but it certainly is serious in its own way, and I think I have solutions that would make an impact for the better. And as someone who's a father of two kids, I often ask myself, will my daughter's America be better than the America I grew up in? And what can I do to make an impact? Now, my involvement in politics certainly has impacted negatively my family from a financial standpoint, just like having been in the military since 1983 negatively impacted my earnings in the aerospace industry. But there's a certain time where you have to rise above narrow or local interests that affect simply your own family, and a time where you have to lift your horizon and consider the impact on your community or your state or your nation. And that's what's kept me going.
Mm-hmm. It seems like a job where somebody is always mad at you.
Yeah, pretty much. It's virtually impossible to, I suppose, if you try to do nothing, it might be possible to have no one mad at you until such time as the people who wanted you to do something find out you've done nothing, at which point yes. They'll be mad with you.
So what's the best thing about the job?
Well, there it's going to be a different answer for every person in office. Let me give you one vignette from my job, that my most recent job in the state assembly, that I think is an example of what kept me going. Probably sometime around 19 or 2008, I was approached by some family members of four women that were being held incommunicado in a Laogai camp, a forced labor camp for political prisoners in China. And they explained to me that their elected officials at the federal and state level had done nothing for them, that they were very frustrated that their elected officials would not use the moral power of their office to try to effect some change for these women that were being held without formal charges, doing hard labor for their religious beliefs. And I looked at it and I thought, oh, geez, this is big. I mean, you've got this massive ancient land with an unelected leadership. You have endemic corruption and political persecution, religious persecution. What can a state assemblyman from California possibly do? But nevertheless, I put my staff to work on it, and we wrote some letters. And what was really kind of surprising is that we ended up getting a bit of a response from the Chinese government. In fact, we got enough of a response that we found out that a couple of the women were formally charged with a crime. And that mattered because what happened when they were formally charged is that the late-night interrogation ceased, the conditions at the labor camp improved, and they were, you know, basically had some rights because they had been formally brought into the system, into the legal system. Mm-hmm. Well, after that, we wrote another letter, and that ended up resulting, as I found out later, in one of the women actually being released. And I found out it quite a remarkable event. I was speaking at the San Diego College Republicans, and the daughter of the woman who was released showed up unannounced and read a letter in public giving me credit for getting her mother out of prison in China. And I just about broke down. I mean, it was such an emotional moment. After that, the Chinese Consul General out of San Francisco demanded to meet with me and explain to me, you know, why it was that these women were part of a dangerous cult on the order of Jim Jones's Jonestown cult, which, of course, is complete baloney. And, you know, I knew that it was, but, you know, he had his propaganda points that he wished to make. And I pressed him firmly, you know, why can't China be a nation that is worthy of its own people insofar as rule of law and respect for minority rights and et cetera. So even though you couldn't say that work was part of the formal job description, I think that using the moral authority of an elected office representing about 500,000 people in California to get someone released from prison in China is a good example of why serving in public office has a particular satisfaction attached to it.
Mm-hmm. What has surprised you most about your job?
You know, I don't know as if a lot has really surprised me because, well, I've worked in the private sector for 13 years. I've been active as a volunteer in politics since age 19, and I've actually worked as a staffer for a congressman. I worked as a staffer for a state senator. I worked as a White House appointee for Weinberger in the Pentagon. So I've kind of been around elected officials and politics off and on for, you know, going back to 1981. You know, I think that looking back on it, I think that perhaps the thing that would surprise me in retrospect would be that just the amount of time spent on the road away from one's family, flying back and forth, in my case, between Southern California and Sacramento. It certainly also did not surprise me that as a conservative in a liberal state that I wasn't able to get a lot done. I kind of knew that going in. But in spite of that, I was able to get 7 bills passed into law. And, you know, there were a few things that I was able to stop as well that I would count as victories. But, yeah, for me, I don't think there was a terrible large, you know, surprise about what I was getting into.
Yeah. Well, more with Chuck DeVore. But first, let me remind you of the good work done by the ALS Association. When it was founded in 1985, I'd never really heard of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. I'd heard of Lou Gehrig, the baseball player, and that he had some kind of disease, but he was way before my time. And I knew the actor David Niven had the disease. But when my mom was diagnosed with ALS in 1987 and died from it the following year, then I paid attention. This is a terrible disease. It's not contagious, but it is progressive. It's a neuromuscular disorder that gradually kills you. Your brain is connected to your muscles by motor neurons. In ALS, the muscles work fine, or at least they would if they received signals from the brain. But the motor neurons that carry the instructions die off. No signals, no movement. No movement, no strength, and finally, no breathing. So it's important to figure out how these motor neurons work, and how to keep them alive. If you want to become a researcher, here's an interesting area to pursue. And if research isn't your thing, but you want to help, go to ALSA.org and donate to the ALS Association. Your help would be greatly appreciated. So, Chuck, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
Usually that comes from my wife. When you're married for 23 years to a strong woman who has her own center, her own, certainly she's not at all a passive woman. I think that most of my motivation would come from her. In addition, I'm a man of faith, and back when I was actively serving the National Guard, if I wasn't in uniform on a Sunday, I'd be in church with my family. And, that's something that we continue today. And so I would say, for me, the, twin motivational pillars would be, my faith and my long-suffering wife.
Let me turn the question around. When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
Typically, it's just with reflecting that no matter how bad things are, they're certainly not as bad as I'm aware that other people have it. Mm-hmm. I have full use of my limbs. I'm I've got the ability to work. I've got a family who loves me. And so I find that thinking about other people's circumstance and other people who persevered in spite of odds that were even greater against them. And I think that's one of the reasons why when people have an active prayer life, when they actively pray about things that, for example, for people who are suffering from challenges far greater than your own, it helps put things into perspective. And I think that's something very important for people to do, that typically, no matter how bad things are for any particular individual, there's somebody out there at some time who has been through something similar, and there's a lot of folks out there who are going through a lot worse.
Mm-hmm. Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
I think that if you look at the time that I spent running for U.S. Senate in California, raising $2.5 million over 300 stops, it's a huge state. Doing that, and then, very quickly, terming out of office, and from a energy level going from 1,000,000 miles an hour to near zero, and then on top of it, right after the November elections, when I was soon to be without a job, the health of my in-laws declined markedly, and we took them into our house. I would say that really the past 9 months has probably been the most challenging time in my life, especially dealing with, having my in-laws now living with us and having the responsibility of caring for them. It's the right thing to do, and I'm glad that my kids have the opportunity to see, what right looks like. But just because it's the right thing to do doesn't mean that it's easy or simple.
Mm-hmm. Do you see yourself running for office again?
Well, the funny thing you should ask, I am running for office. I guess I'm not doing a good job if you weren't aware of that every day, but I'm running for Orange County Board of Supervisors, 3rd District. That's the seat that Bill Campbell currently has. He's termed out, and there'll be an election in June of next year, June of 2012, and if no one gets 50% plus one, a runoff in November of next year.
Mm. So something closer to home.
Yes. In fact, the commute is about 13 minutes from my house. Not that I'm counting. Yes.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, what would you say? What would be your best advice?
Oh, my. I suppose the number one thing is to not focus, merely on career or on money. Find something that you have passion for. Find something that that you will be excited about waking up for every morning. Something that don't discount doing things that can change the world. Although, frankly, just about every job you can change the world from if you look at it correctly. The importance of faith in the equation of strong friendships. So I think it would be a, I guess it wouldn't be too terribly different from a lot of other commencement speech have been made over the years.
I believe that ideas can be life-changing. Is there an idea that has changed your life?
Well, in the secular world, you know, the idea that makes America exceptional, the idea that governments exist to secure our unalienable rights, the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that the purpose of government is to secure our liberties. This is a powerful idea, and it stands in stark distinction from the modern conception of what we have today, the progressive administrative state, where you have a burgeoning body of regulations and laws prescribing for the people how they should run their lives, telling everyone from the, you know, the most humble person to the largest corporation exactly what they can and can't do. Well, this certainly is not the conception of freedom or liberty that our founding fathers had. And I think that the challenge that we have, and the reason why this idea, while it's powerful, is often under assault, is that people that go into public service don't typically go into public service to give up power. They go in to accumulate power. And that stands in contrast with the founding principles of America, which where government was supposed to be the servant of the people and to ensure their liberties. And so that idea is what motivates me in my public service and keeps me fighting against what I often perceive as pretty long odds.
The last question is to help me get better at this process. Think of a defining moment in your life. Is there a question I should have asked for have you to tell me that story?
Not really certain that I can put my finger on a specific event. I think of things like, you know, watching the first man walk on the moon, watching the first flight of the 747 at Boeing Field, and going on one of the other test craft and remembering the words of the person who was giving the tour that the wingspan of the 747 was longer than the Wright brothers' first flight. And as a seven-year-old, those, you know, that phrase stuck with me all of these years later. So, you know, I've certainly, you know, retained an interest in engineering and science and aerospace, worked in the aerospace industry for 13 years, probably because of those formative years during the U.S. space program and during the, living near where Boeing had so many of their facilities.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank Chuck DeVore for joining me today. Thanks, Chuck. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.